At sea, September 1857. The brig Mary, out of Greenock, Scotland, rescued three men at 4 o'clock Monday afternoon, 8 days and 20 hours since they had been cast adrift as the Central America went to the bottom. The captain of the Mary logged the coordinate at the time of their rescue, 3640 latitude, 7600 longitude, which meant that since the sinking they had drifted to the northeast almost 500 miles. Bob had discovered this extraordinary story early in his research, and despite his curiosity at how the men could have mustered the will to survive, he saw immediately the mathematical value of the tale. Although the course and width of the Gulf Stream alters from time to time, this information greatly narrowed the site of the sinking, and Tommy guarded it closely. He had not revealed it even to Larry Stone. But when Stone's probability maps failed to overlap, Tommy told Stone to re-estimate everything, assuming a 3-knot current always headed northeast. He wanted to see if that made a difference. And it did, said Stone. Once we put that in, then the maps started to overlap rather nicely. That means that the information we were using from these three independent sources was now consistent. Aboard the Pine River for the search phase with the Sea Mark 1A, 200 miles off the Carolina coast, June 1986. The steel bow of the Pine River shot upward 8 feet, then slammed down, shuddering all the way to the fantail. A 40-knot wind whipped the sea white beneath lightning tearing at the night sky. When the stern dropped, water exploded over the fantail and rolled 100 feet up the flat deck to crash against the control room, where the sonar tech sat trying to figure out what was wrong with the Sea Mark. The Pine River was a flat-bottomed mud boat from the Louisiana oil patch, built to ferry drilling mud and supplies out to the oil rigs in the Gulf. Tommy had found her in a shipyard in Orange, Texas, while scouting with a former Navy commander named Don Kraft. In his late 50s, Kraft had retired after 30 years in the Navy with an unlimited master's ticket. He could skipper any vessel in any ocean. Kraft then had ripped out a lot of old equipment from a previous charter. When he left Orange, he had the Pine River on a 60-day charter beginning the 14th of May and running through the end of July. 8 days later, he arrived in Jacksonville, ready to place the tow point and the winch, weld a modified log boom to the deck for launching and recovering the 1,200-pound Sea Mark, fire up the galley, fill the ship with groceries, and await Mike Williamson and the sonar techs for mobilization. Six men from the Louisiana Bayou kept the Pine River clean, running, and pointed in the right direction. Don Kraft oversaw the operation. 24 hours a day, Williamson and his sonar crew of 11 manned the electronics in the control room. Tommy was Williamson's client, and as the client, he was supposed to watch and listen. But he had $1.4 million in his pocket from partners who counted on him, and he would no more leave Williamson alone to run the Sea Mark survey at sea than he would have left Larry Stone alone to produce the probability map. The map Stone presented to Tommy was neat and precise, specific little numbers and perfect little cells, each representing a 2-mile square of ocean. At the end of each line forming the grid, top and side, Stone had included the latitude and longitude down to the nearest minute. Within most of the cells appeared a number from 0 to 73, indicating the probability out of 1,000 that the ship would be located in that 2-mile square. The highest cell had a 7.3% chance of containing the shipwreck site. The many cells marked 0 had some probability, but less than 1 chance in 1,000. Mike Williamson and a colleague had then taken Stone's probability map, factored in topography, weather, and the velocity and direction of currents, and designed a search map, the most efficient way to run track lines back and forth through the highest probability cells on Stone's map. But as they were experiencing in the first few days of the search, the currents never ran true and the equipment never operated without flaw, and the ocean never lay still. For 3 days now, weather had kept the Sea Mark on deck. They had left Jacksonville in rough weather just after midnight on June 3rd. It was a hurricane, said sonar technician John Lethow, and then it was downgraded as it moved offshore out of the Gulf Stream. The techs took advantage of Tropical Storm Andrew to solve one Sea Mark problem after another. On the afternoon of June 7th, they reassembled the Sea Mark and launched it, but no sooner had the towfish hit the water than they discovered more problems. They recovered the towfish and again tore it apart. Tommy was always there, watching the techs, trying to work with them, seeing hours and then days spin by on the clock. He was spending $20,000 a day on the best sonar experts in the world, and until their sonar worked, they were surveying nothing. The afternoon of the 8th, they redeployed the Seamark and began towing again along track line 1. On the first track line, they would follow a course through probability cells equaling just over 25% of the distribution. One chance in 4, they would image the Central America in that first 30-mile run. They would then turn around and run the next track line back, overlapping half of the first track and imaging a mile and a half strip of New Bottom, turn around and head back again on track line 3. At the end of that line, they would have covered nearly 50% of the probability. Tommy worried that the Central America was in one of those high-probability cells in that first track line, where the Seamark was not working. That the Central America with those gigantic paddle wheels and all that gold stuffed in her belly would glide right on by and no one would notice. "I'd sometimes go in there in the middle of the night," Tommy said, "and everybody'd be asleep on the EPC recorders." Ted Brockett, who had designed the sled for the towfish, understood Tommy's concern, but he sympathized with Williamson. "Harvey was always underfoot," said Brockett. "If something wasn't working right, he'd get in there with his calculator and a pencil. I spent a fair amount of time soothing egos and trying to keep those two guys calmed down. No one was throwing punches, but the discussions got fairly heated." After the weather cleared and the swells and the winds subsided, they finally had the Seamark calibrated and tuned, and the two crews coordinated on the towing. For the next 2 weeks, they had run 30-mile track lines, mowing the lawn, as they called it, overlapping each track so as not to miss anything. 30 miles down, 5 hours to turn around, crab over 2,500 meters, and then 30 miles back. The towfish flew a few hundred meters above the ocean floor, its ears listening for a sonar return, a bounce of its sound waves off a solid object anywhere within its range of 5,000 meters. Enclosed at the head of the back deck, the control room was filled with racks of electronics, recorders, and computers. Williamson ran 2 towers, or shifts, a day. The day tower from noon to midnight, and the night tower from midnight to noon. As the Seamark passed slowly and silently over the ocean floor a mile and a half beneath the surface of the sea, 5 graphic recorders looking like large IBM Selectric typewriters ran full time. The room smelled of ozone and graphite from the styli burning the special coating off the paper, and the recorders sat covered in black dust. If a target appeared on the bottom, the styli would spark several times and leave dark marks on the paper. The tech, monitoring the recorders, would alert navigation that he had contact and note the time of the contact in the logbook and in the margin of the strip chart. Immediately, someone would bring a ruler and try to gauge its length. The paper moved slowly on, the figure taking shape as they watched. When the Seamark had passed a target, they radioed the bridge for the ship's speed, plotted its position, read the cable gauge for how many feet of tow line they had out, and recorded all of it in the logs. Later, they could return to that spot for a closer look. "No target acquisition data has any validity unless it's repeatable," noted Kraft. "You have to be able to go back to the same spot, otherwise you haven't learned anything when you see a target." As the Seamark flew above the ocean floor and shot signals back to the EPC recorders, simultaneously the computer started to paint a color version of the same target. By the time they had blown up, colored, thresholded, filtered, highlighted, and otherwise stretched the information on that target, what appeared to be a thumbprint on the strip chart might look like a steamship with paddle wheels on the computer screen. Will Watson was monitoring the EPC recorders late one night when they acquired their first large sonar target, an anomaly on the seafloor that could be the wreck of the Central America. Tommy was in the control room, and Watson motioned him to come over. "Here's our first target." Harvey said, "Wow," remembered Watson, and you just saw the sparkle in his eye. He knew at that moment that this system could find wooden shipwrecks on the seafloor. 10 to 20 minutes a day, the styli drew the black and white image of an anomaly, something that stood out against the sediment on the ocean floor. But most anomalies they quickly discarded. Cargo containers ripped loose in a storm, a German U-boat sunk in World War II, sailboats and fishing boats gone down. Every two or three days, one of the two tech teams would see a single target about the right size, about the right density, that could be the wreck of the Central America. When Williamson came on the night tower, he analyzed the data from the previous 12-hour shift. No one questioned Williamson's eye. He could see things in a sonar return no one else could see. They had now completed half the track lines on the search map, yet because those lines ran through the cells of a much higher probability, they had already covered 86th percentile on the probability map, and they had imaged hundreds of anomalies. Williamson dismissed most of them. The few left became key targets. Williamson called this short list the hit parade. He next arranged the hit parade in order, according to each target's resemblance to the models Tommy had developed of what the wreck of the Central America would look like after 130 years on the ocean floor. And from the moment he saw it, one stood out, even on the strip chart. It appeared to be a side-wheel steamer, resting upright on the bottom, a dark hump shadow amidships indicating paddle wheels. Williamson designated the target Sidewheel. They had already imaged so many targets in the high-probability cells that Williamson now wanted to shut down the broad swath survey, drop the C-mark to a lower altitude, tighten the swath from 5,000 to 1,000 meters, and go back for a much closer look at the good targets, especially Sidewheel. With the swath at 5,000 meters, all they could tell was that something large sat on the ocean floor. At 1,000 meters, even images produced by sound would look almost like a picture. Williamson himself realized the irony in what he wanted to do. He was always the one to insist they complete the broad swath search before they look closer at any of the targets, because the target that appeared promising on sonar may not be the target they were looking for. "We'd made a big issue of this with Harvey," said Williamson. Now Williamson was the one suggesting they deviate from the plan, and he had good reason. The weather had finally died down, and the 1,000-meter search required these smoother conditions. They could run the 5,000-meter search in much rougher weather. 10 of the 12 technicians on board thought about the same as Williamson. In the control room, the techs had Sidewheel frozen on the computer screen, taking Polaroids, measuring parts of the ship, and pulling more information from the image. Tommy finally agreed to let Williamson run high-resolution passes on each of the promising targets, not because Williamson insisted or the other techs pressured him, but because he had calculated how much time they needed to complete the broad swath search, and they still could get it done in what remained of the 40 days. If the sea mark held up and the weather did not kick them in the teeth any harder than it already had. On June 24th, they began reacquiring the targets on the hit parade for the high-resolution flyovers. By the end of the second day, they had reacquired and shot several at close range. Tommy unrolled blueprints none of the techs had known existed, and for the first time they saw a sharp outline of a sidewheel steamer they had been looking for. They measured different parts of the ship and compared the dimensions to what they were finding on the higher resolution images. More than one target looked good in this second round. But when Williamson saw the computer enhancements of these closer, high-resolution passes of sidewheel, he wanted to skip even the close-up work on the other good targets and immediately drop a camera on it. Tommy insisted they continue to take advantage of the good weather to shoot one high-resolution pass on the other major targets already imaged at 5,000 meters, even though some of those targets lay in low-probability cells in the southwest corner of the search map, 40 miles away. At midnight on the 25th of June, the Pine River was en route to the new location, and by noon they were in the middle of a new track line, headed almost due west. Into the second run, no more than 15 minutes, they began to see what appeared to be rock outcroppings or drifts of sand. The navigator wrote on the strip chart, "Contact 200 meters port." Geology? Then, as they neared the end of that track, the EPC recorders began to sketch another anomaly, one at the far northern edge of the sonar range. They turned the ship, shifted 800 meters to the north, and began their third run at the target. Early in the line, they saw more of what appeared to be geology. Then suddenly, the recorders began to paint what someone later described as a real banger. It was big and it was bright, but not big enough and maybe too bright for an old wooden shipwreck. To square off, they searched the area along the southern boundary, and Tommy now wanted to run a final east-west track. The techs wanted to get back to Sidewheel, but Tommy had them raise the swath to 5,000 meters, and they ran the final track line almost due east. Late in the afternoon on June 28th, they steamed again towards Sidewheel. They shot it 6 times. The closer they got and the tighter they focused, the more the image resembled a photograph of the Central America. Williamson recorded in his log, "This target appears to have the characteristics of our objective." But Tommy still would not let Williamson drop the camera. The only way they could image the site with a camera was to dangle the sled on the cable and drag it back and forth in short tracks, much as they ran the sonar sweeps. Except they had to get the camera within 20 feet. The method required patience and too much luck. Tommy had no time for patience or luck. He agreed to finish a suite of high-resolution sonar images of Sidewheel, but then he insisted they sweep the parts of the search map they still had not covered. To keep the tech crew as objective as possible in the beginning, Tommy had purposely told them little about the Central America. But over the days of evaluating targets with Tommy and Williamson, they slowly had gleaned a set of criteria that any target must possess to be a candidate. It had to be about 300 feet long, about 50 feet wide, have 3 masts, 2 sidewheels, and 1 boiler stack. And it had to be made of wood, although 750 tons of degrading iron and about 200 tons of coal might also litter the site. As they dropped the Sea Mark closer to Sidewheel, in the shadows of the images, they saw a huge hump amidships that would be the housing for one of the paddle wheels. Williamson had only one nagging problem with Sidewheel. No matter how they estimated, it seemed smaller than the Central America was when it entered the storm. Then the techs learned that some of the 500 passengers and crew left behind had chopped up large portions of the ship to make rafts, and the techs surmised that upon impact with the sea floor, the weakened ship had accordioned. Williamson continued to study the target. He recorded in his log, "Search team recommends deployment of transponders for camera runs." But Tommy wanted to look into every probability cell that contained a number higher than 0. To the west were several with numbers from 2 through 8, and more to the east had numbers from 1 to 7. A few chances out of 1,000 that the Central America lay beneath that 2-mile square of ocean. About 10 hours into that next eastern track line, they imaged another target large enough and bright enough for Williamson to add to the hit parade, and it was labeled Galaxy. But Tommy still wanted to run the final eastern track, even though the total of all the chances out of 1,000 that the Central America lay along that track was 3. Tommy wanted to run that line and even extend it by 19 kilometers. For 10 hours, they towed the Sea Mark along that far eastern track line. Then the wind began to kick up, and before they had reached the end of the line, they had to abort the run. But now Tommy wanted a high-resolution look at Galaxy, the anomaly they had imaged the day before. Williamson had already studied the broad swath image of Galaxy and determined it was not a mid-19th century sidewheel steamer. On the first attempt, they hit the target in less than 4 minutes. They tightened the swath to 500 meters, turned and swept the target a second time, then turned and swept it again for the third and final time. Now Tommy had at least 1, and often 2 or 3 high-resolution images of every major target they had located. He calculated they had now covered enough of the map, that with only 3 or 4 days remaining, the time would be more wisely spent either running closer looks at the promising targets or trying to drop a camera on Sidewheel. "We ultimately prevailed," said Lethow, "and we put the video camera down on that shipwreck." They deployed the camera sled early on the morning of July 7th. To see any detail, the camera had to be within 20 feet of the wreck. On the first pass, they towed the camera sled and watched the monitor for 2 hours and saw nothing but snow. On camera run 2, they saw the bottom briefly. They tried a third camera run, and within an hour, Lethow piloted the camera over anchor chain. Then a ghostly image of what appeared to be timbers crossed the monitor. They realigned the ship for another drift, and 2 hours later, they again saw a piece of the wreck. Then they saw what they thought was debris near the wreck. But in all these passes, they could never tell what they were seeing or where they were in the wreck site. The second night into the close-in camera work, Lethow said, "What are the chances of us picking up that anchor chain again in the middle of all these sea cucumber trails and then finding a shipwreck attached to it?" About 5 heartbeats later, big and dark and right in the middle of the monitor, appeared the anchor chain, and Lethow had the camera running parallel. "Jesus," yelled Lethow, "look at that." Watson yelled, "check it out." Everybody was watching the monitor now, including Tommy. They could see across part of a deck to what looked like cable shrouds from a mast and some sort of superstructure. The whole scene had lasted less than a minute. Letow started singing Chain, 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 and the other techs raised their hands and started dancing and singing with Letow, all of them rummy from 6 weeks at sea. But the magic never worked again. The weather had worsened since they began the camera runs 2 days earlier, the sea chopping into bigger and bigger hills, the wind rising. Williamson had commitments with oil companies. They had reached the limit of their capability for that summer. "We did not have an ROV available to go to that depth," explained Kraft. "There were no ROVs anywhere that could make that depth." That was Tommy's next challenge, to create an ROV, a robot, that could work that deep. Tommy and Barry asked the techs to cast a confidence vote on Sidewheel. When they tallied the results, the techs collectively had voted that Sidewheel had a 90% chance of being the wreck of the Central America. "The percentages were pretty damn high," said Tommy, "but it still wasn't good to get cranked up." At 7 o'clock on the morning of July 9th, they recovered the camera sled, then pointed the bow of the Pine River toward the beach. Columbus, Ohio, Fall, 1986. The public's awareness and excitement over all that was possible in the world beneath the sea heightened in the summer of 1986. George Bass from Texas A&M's Institute of Nautical Archaeology had uncovered ornate gold pendants, weapons, and stores of bronze, tin, and glass while exploring a wooden vessel sunk in 150 feet of water off Turkey 34 centuries ago. Mel Fisher had recovered more treasure from the Atocha, and less than a quarter mile off Cape Cod, Barry Clifford had begun salvaging the spoils from the pirate ship Whydah. But what truly inflamed the public's collective imagination was Bob Ballard's return to the Queen of the Deep, the RMS Titanic. For 12 days in 12,500 feet of water, Ballard and his crew had dived to film her for 60 hours. Memories of a lifetime ago awakened, and though everyone thought she had been lost forever, in Ballard's photographs and film, the Titanic dramatically lived again in all her decaying splendor. Tommy now had to raise $3.6 million for the verification and recovery phase. In November, he sent to his partners a letter announcing a meeting on December 13th at the Great Southern Hotel in downtown Columbus. At the meeting, Tommy finished his presentation with a suite of high-resolution images they had of Sidewheel. Buck Patton was trying to be skeptical. "But here's this target," he remembered, "and you can see the side wheel on it." It was a great presentation, and we all walked out of there feeling like we've got it. In less than a month, Tommy had sold 41.5 of the 50 recovery phase units at $72,000 a unit, all to partners who had invested in the search phase. The partners were confident now, even excited. But as always, Tommy was advising caution. He admonished the partners again to keep quiet. Their security policy had allowed him to consider all options without pressure from potential competition. "Such freedom," he wrote, "will become more important than ever leading up to recovery operations." Tommy had assigned Ted Brockett, who had sailed as part of Williamson's crew the previous summer, to snoop around in the ocean community and learn about deep water recovery systems for sale and for lease. Brockett had designed the sled for Williamson's Seamark 1A, and he had designed and built other deep water recovery systems, working with several of the ocean engineers he would need to consult for Tommy. His connections were an advantage, but he had to proceed surreptitiously. The community was so small, and the equipment so rare and specialized, that one word too specific and the listener could quickly calculate what you were about to do and where you were about to do it. It all had to do with depth. The deeper you went, the greater the pressure. The greater the pressure, the stronger the seals had to be, or salt water seeped into the electronic housings. And the cable required to run an ROV was so complex and expensive, no one ever ordered more than they had to. If you worked in about 4,000 feet of water, you used about 5,000 feet of cable. You couldn't use less. You couldn't afford more. To disguise the venture, Tommy and Brockett developed fuzzy brackets. Parameters specific enough for engineers to solve the right problems, but not so specific they could figure out the project. Then Brockett discovered the perfect cover, Bob Ballard and the Titanic. He learned that if he phrased part of his requirements like this, and must be capable of recovering an array of objects in deep water, The engineers always shifted to questions about the luxury liner. Then it was easy for Brockett to say, "Aw, shucks, he really was not at liberty to divulge the name of his client or the project," which convinced everyone it really was the Titanic. While he had Brockett out schmoozing with the deep ocean crowd, Tommy continued to experiment with designs for his own vehicle. He had contacted an ROV operator named John Moore. If you asked anybody in the worldwide offshore community who is the best ROV operator in the business, they would say John Moore. If you asked them who is the most temperamental, cantankerous son of a bitch they've ever been around, they would also say John Moore. "I have a foul temper," Moore says of himself. "Always have, probably always will. I am firmly convinced that the world is mostly populated with idiots." John Moore stood 6'2", lanky, his blue eyes intense above a thick, dark, droopy mustache. Moore was so good at operating the new remotely operated vehicles, he began to design and build them himself. He told Tommy that the big capital costs were in the cable, the propulsion, and the housings. He confirmed that a battery-operated ROV on a simple coax cable was the cheapest way to get to the bottom. Although the coax cable had limited capability, they could buy components off the shelf that would push more signals down the cable. They didn't need expensive housings to protect the instruments on the bottom. They could use glass spheres. They didn't have to send power down the cable. They could put battery packs on the vehicle itself. Most people would not design it this way, but it was possible. And it was the way Tommy liked to think. How can we keep it simple and inexpensive by rethinking the whole approach? In the late 1960s, the U.S. Navy created a manned underwater environment called Sea Lab, and they hired Don Hackman at Battelle to design a machine shop for it. In his late 40s, Hackman still had dark brown hair. His wardrobe consisted of three things: Navy pants, Navy shorts for hot weather at sea, and light blue shirts. Another engineer once came to a costume party dressed as Don Hackman, and no one missed the joke. Tommy had watched Hackman work, and he liked Hackman's thinking. When Tommy arrived at Hackman's office, he told Hackman, "I've found a ship, and I'm ready for a contract." Battelle policy allowed the engineers to take on outside projects as long as they filled out the proper papers and explained how they and Battelle would benefit from the experience. After Tommy talked to Hackman, he met with his old boss at Battelle, Don Frink, and persuaded Frink that developing a deep-sea robot would be a good experience for some of the Battelle engineers. Tommy went back to Hackman with a contract for a feasibility study on deep-water tools to cut through decks. Hackman compared working in the deep ocean to working in space, except in many ways, working in the deep ocean was more difficult. Saltwater ate tools. The other major problem was pressure. Despite the pressure, joints had to bend, bearings had to roll, impellers had to spin, hydraulics had to flow. In January, Tommy heard the first vague rumor through the deep ocean grapevine that someone else was preparing an expedition to search for the Central America. After 3 months of traveling coast to coast, sounding out engineers in the deep ocean community, Brockett had 5 proposals from the deep water ROV companies. Not one offered fresh thinking. Some proposals incorporated equipment Tommy thought of as toys. It's amazing what people said they could do versus what I knew they could do. Brockett had found what might be a workable approach. A combination of 2 existing vehicles modified with thickened housings and new flotation. Then one day, Harvey called me out of the blue, recalled Brockett, and he said, "Nope, forget all that. We're going to build our own." Brockett was incredulous. "That was like February or March," he said. "There's no way in the world you can start from ground zero and design and build an ROV in a few months. You can't get a cable in less than 6 months." But Tommy had concluded that no one else out there knew any more about working on the floor of the deep ocean than he did. And that was all he needed to know. For years, in his head and on sketch pads, Tommy had been designing an underwater robot. Except for a small group of pre-programmed submersibles, all robots, or ROVs, such as Tommy wanted to build, were controlled by a cable connected to a ship. Rule number 1 in designing underwater ROV work systems was do as much as you can on deck. Keep it all topside, your brains, your power, and send it down to the vehicle on a multi-conductor coaxial cable. But a coax cable, was 2 inches in diameter, and you still need several smaller cables to run everything on the vehicle. The central cable alone cost about $25 a foot, and each of the smaller coax cables ran another $5. With design costs included, you could put almost $1 million into just a few wires and some armoring. One piece of Tommy's concept shared by many engineers trying to work in the deep ocean was keep it simple. But Tommy pushed for simplicity where others either hadn't thought to look or had looked and tried but given up. His first move was to operate everything down below with one thin coax cable. But one small coax cable couldn't transfer power downside and still have room for the signals needed to run everything else. All those signals chasing up and down at the same time on that tiny copper wire banged into each other, and the cable overheated and the electronics fritzed at both ends. For hours on the phone that winter, Tommy ran what he called thought experiments with John Moore and the other engineers, looking for ways to make it all work on a single cable. Tommy wanted to try putting the power down below on the vehicle, so they wouldn't have to send it down from topside. That had been done before, but the battery packs put out too little power. Tommy wondered out loud if they could somehow stretch that power. After weeks of brainstorming with Tommy and consulting with the engineers, Moore thought he could get enough power to the vehicle and still shoot enough signals down that single coax to operate everything Tommy wanted. Tommy phoned Hackman and asked him to call around to his suppliers to find out how soon and for how much he could get a 1-inch coaxial cable about 12,000 feet long. Hackman started calling, and on his second call, a manufacturer said, "I've got some coax already sitting here that's 3/4 of an inch, 13,000 feet of it. Somebody had ordered the cable and then couldn't pay, so it had been sitting around for 2 or 3 years, and the man wanted to get rid of it. I'll sell it for $1 a foot, he told Hackman. That was an 80% discount. Hackman called Tommy, and Tommy called Moore and asked him if he could still do everything they had talked about on a 3/4-inch cable. Moore said he probably could. Toward the end of February 1987, the March issue of Life magazine appeared on newsstands in Columbus. The cover read, "The Search for Lost Treasures, 8 Great Mysteries of the Americas." Inside was a 1.5-page spread of Mel Fisher in a bathing suit. The caption read, "This lucky man found his, but others lie unclaimed." Number 2 on the list of 8 was titled "The Gold Rush's Saddest Claim," and in one short paragraph told the story of the sinking of the Central America. In a large inset was a photograph of a Charleston man named Lee Spence, a bearded fellow with a pleasant face. "He believes he has discovered where the Central America lies," said the article, "and hopes to beat competitors to the prize within 2 years. All the pieces of the puzzle are there," Spence was quoted. "It's a rush to the finish now." Tommy's partners, many with $50,000 to $100,000 in the project, got nervous. From the beginning, Tommy had warned they might have competition, and to ensure that he would be there first, Tommy had even conceived the emergency plan. He could activate to get out to the site quickly if he had to. Ted Brockett had to design the framework for Moore to hang all of his ingenuity on, and he realized that the key to its design was flexibility. One day it had to be a passively towed camera sled, long and skinny, and the next day be squat and strong enough to sit on the bottom and work in the debris field, pick up ceramic cups and small gold coins or 1,000-pound anchors, and put them into a basket or tie ropes around them and bring them back to the surface. And the day after that, it had to be tall and thin enough to drop through a narrow hatch and look around for gold. And that's what Brockett was working on when Tommy called him on March 20th. Tommy was shifting to the E plan. Tommy had wanted to go to sea with good operating capability toward the end of July and then have August and September to verify the wreck as the Central America, thoroughly photograph and document the site, and retrieve some of the gold. The lawyers had explained to Tommy that before he could claim the sidewheel wreck site, he had to have an artifact from the wreck to take into court, and that single requirement became the design goal for what Tommy now called the emergency vehicle. Maybe not find gold, maybe not even explore the ship, just retrieve an artifact and bring it to the surface and take it to court. Brockett already had told Tommy that trying to build any kind of vehicle before the end of the summer was a futile exercise. Now Tommy said he needed the vehicle in May. Brockett called in every IOU of goodwill he had with his suppliers. Hackman remembered Tommy coming to him about this time and asking how long he thought it would take to build a simple vehicle that could go down 8,000 feet, relocate the wreck, and bring back one artifact. That's all Tommy wanted. Hackman said, 2 years. In April, Don Kraft found Tommy another mud boat out of Louisiana, the Nicor Navigator. One of the crew described her as like a big, giant, long tugboat. Her deck house bunched up on the bow, and from there back ran a flat deck open all the way to the stern. On that wide open deck, Kraft had to create a control room for the techs, a laboratory for Bob Evans, a communication shack for Tommy and Barry, sleeping quarters for the tech crew, storage, large and small repair shops, and install a winch, a crane, a deployment arm, a handling ramp, Starfix satellite navigation electronics, and a dynamic positioning system. Part of what made the deep ocean an impossible barrier was the inability to anchor the surface ship. Anchor chain had to be 5 times longer than depth, and you needed 4 or 5 of those anchors for a 200-foot ship. In only 2,000 feet of water, that would require about 50,000 feet of anchor chain. Dynamic positioning had become the key to all work in the deep ocean. Despite winds, currents, and seas, a combination of navigation systems, interfacing computers, and 2 or 3 large propellers would keep a ship constantly nudging its way back to a prescribed spot. Kraft got quotes from the 4 major DP manufacturers, ranging from $750,000 to $2.5 million, to convert the Nicor Navigator into a dynamic positioning vessel. Then he discovered the Robertson DP system. The Robertson engineers put a system together and installed it in less than a month, all for $130,000. In New Orleans, Kraft also found a crackerjack yard foreman to ramrod the ship conversion. 5 days after the Navigator went on charter, May 5th, they took her into the Gulf and ran sea trials on the new DP system. Everything checked out. 3.5 days after that, Kraft had the Navigator docked at the Atlantic Marine Shipyard on the St. Johns River, about 10 miles out of Jacksonville. Brockett and Moore had shipped a tractor-trailer load of aluminum and electronics to Jacksonville, and were in the yard, beginning to assemble the vehicle, when Tommy, Bob, and Barry arrived on the 18th of May. The 2 other members of the tech team had already joined them in Columbus and were now in Jacksonville. One was an underwater acoustics expert and software wizard, Alan Scott. He would be the one responsible for getting all the navigation and DP computers talking to each other, so he could direct the ship's captain to the proper point on the ocean and guide Moore along the bottom to the wreckage. Scotty stood out on a ship because he always looked crisp when everyone else at sea was rumpled and wrinkled and unshaved. The other member new to the tech team was Tommy's buddy from the James Bay days, John Deering. The last member of the tech team to arrive was Don Hackman, who showed up a few days later wearing navy shorts and a light blue shirt. Brockett and Moore sat in the yard surrounded by unopened boxes of electronics. "It was absolutely nuts," said Brockett. "It was a madhouse." While the E-Plan mobilization continued into late May, the lawyers flew to Jacksonville to meet with Tommy and decide one thing. Should they file an admiralty claim with the court? If they did, they had to reveal their coordinates. If they didn't, they risked someone else finding the wreck and filing a claim first.